Today on Inside Politics, a strict law passed before we had x-rays and antibiotics will now ban virtually all abortions in the swing state of Arizona. Republicans are rushing to condemn an Arizona court ruling that rolls abortion rights back to the Civil War era. It's igniting a massive GOP problem in November that Donald Trump thought he had just tamped down. Plus, President Biden is about to answer questions from reporters. We're going to bring that to you live this hour as new economic numbers show inflation on key items once again headed in the wrong direction. And it could all come down to one vote. That's why Republicans are fighting to change the way Nebraska awards its electoral votes. And what happens in that state could be crucial in deciding who sits in the Oval Office next year. I'm Dana Bash. Let's go behind the headlines and inside politics. Up first, whatever states decide must be the law of the land. That was Donald Trump's big announcement on abortion rights this week. The very next day, voters learned what it actually looks like to punt abortion rights to the states. In Arizona, it's a Civil War era law that bans nearly all abortions in that state. Moments ago, Trump responded to the Arizona ruling for the first time.
Mr. President, did Arizona go too far? Did Arizona go too far?
Yeah, they did, and that'll be straightened out. And as you know, it's all about states' rights. That'll be straightened out. And I'm sure that the governor and everybody else are going to bring it back into reason, and that'll be taken care of, I think, very quickly.
What do you think about Florida?
Florida's probably maybe going to change also. See, it's all of what the will of the people. This is what I've been saying. It's a perfect system.
The Arizona Supreme Court also puts the state in the same category as 14 others that ban abortion with very, very limited exceptions. In five additional states, abortion is banned within the first trimester. Some of those states, namely Arizona, North Carolina, and Georgia, could decide the election this fall. Let's bring in my great panel, CNN's Priscilla Alvarez, CNN and Bloomberg's Nia Malika Henderson, and The Washington Post's Mariana Sotomayor. Hello, everybody. Let's first talk about what we just heard from Donald Trump. On the one hand, he said he doesn't agree with what Arizona did. On the other hand, he's sticking by what he said on Monday, which is the states should decide. He also said something additional on Roe.
For 52 years, people have wanted to end Roe v. Wade to get it back to the states. We did that. It was an incredible thing, an incredible achievement. We did that, and now the states have it, and the states are putting out what they want. It's the will of the people.
I mean, it's an incredible achievement. That is going to be, I mean, he said it before, but the fact that he's saying it in the context of what Arizona just did, I can't imagine that the Biden campaign isn't already cutting that.
That's right. And, you know, and the Biden campaign has been very proactive on this, right? Mm-hmm. Kamala Harris is set to go out to Tucson, Arizona this weekend. They had an ad featuring a woman from Texas who had these horrific experiences because she was denied an abortion in Texas, cut an ad called, you know, Donald Trump did this. So mm-hmm. Donald Trump thought he was kind of being clever on Monday with that statement and saying, avoiding whether or not he would actually sign a national abortion ban. And then saying, listen, the status quo is the status quo. And here he is just outright lying. The idea that people for years wanted Roe overturned, conservatives wanted it overturned. But now if you look at the polling, even in a state like Arizona, it's a 65-35 issue. 65% wanting abortion rights and 35% wanted either no abortion or sort of limited abortion.
Well, the people who brought him to the dance initially in 2015, absolutely.
Yeah.
Wanted him to overturn Roe. And he did start out life when he first dabbled in the idea of running for president, which he didn't in 2000, very openly self-described pro-choice. So he had to make a lot of transactions, as he
right.
is wont to do, in order to get the support of the evangelicals. Poof, here we are.
Well, and to Nia's point about where the Biden campaign has been in all of this, they obviously seized on this early on. We can go back to the midterms, but even kicking off the year is when the vice president kicked off a reproductive rights tour in Wisconsin and has been going to states since then, including visiting a clinic. But I spoke to a Biden campaign official earlier today who told me they're now going to pour more money into abortion-related ads in Arizona. Of course, this was part of a big ad buy that they're doing across battleground states, but they do see the opportunity, even if they've already been in this space. And also, in talking to Democratic strategists, they see this as a continuation of the same storyline, but another data point in that, another moment that they can point to say this is the chaos and confusion that has unfolded since the Dobbs ruling, and trying to use that and fuel their messaging as they go across the country. But again, it's a space they've been in. It just kind of adds more fuel to all of that.
And let's just drill down on Arizona and how important Arizona is when it comes to the Electoral College. 2016, Arizona, its 11 electoral votes went to Donald Trump, as up until last year, or last cycle, tended to do, go on the Republican side. That did not happen in 2020. Joe Biden won Arizona in 2020 by little more than 10,000 votes. It was incredibly close. And even before we saw this ruling, the stunning ruling this yesterday, by the Arizona State Supreme Court, there was already a move to get choice for people who want it on the ballot in Arizona. That's not a sure thing, but it's hard to imagine it won't get more energy into it. Right. And that would mean that there would be more people probably going to the polls to vote in general in November.
Yeah, and what we have seen in the midterms and since, when states have left this question up to voters, they turn out, and they turn out in support of abortion rights. That is what I think the Biden campaign is hoping for. It's what a lot of Democrats in Congress are hoping for, as the Senate race is definitely one that can control the majority of the Senate, keep control either for Democrats or go to the Republicans. Absolutely something that I'm hearing from House Democrats all the time. I mean, there are a number of swing seats, just one in particular on the border, and it's Juan Ciscomani's seat. He's a Republican, vulnerable, and he, I mean, put out quite a statement yesterday just saying, you know, this is wrong. And when he was running during the midterms, he was really squishy, literally ran away from questions to talk about his position on abortion. Now they're trying to make it very clear where they stand.
It's funny that you brought up Juan Ciscomani. I went out to do a story, I think you did as well, on his race, because it was one of the tightest races and one of the few places where a Republican actually unseated an incumbent Democrat, despite how energized people were on abortion. And I witnessed that. He's very much open about being pro-choice, but he's kind of a crystallized example of somebody who wants to kind of find a middle ground that's very hard to find on this issue. Down ballot, he's one example in Arizona. The other, of course, is the Senate race, Carrie Lake. Let's listen to both Carrie Lake and Juan Ciscomani, or excuse me, I'm going to read these. Carrie Lake said, "This is a very personal issue that should be determined by each individual state and her people. I oppose today's ruling, and I am calling on Katie Hobbs and the state legislature to come up with an immediate common sense solution." And then, Mariana, to your point, here's what Ciscomani said. "Today's ruling is a disaster for women and providers. I'm a strong supporter of empowering women to make their own health care choices, and I oppose a national ban."
Yeah, listen, I mean, we should point out that Carrie Lake in 2022 praised this law, the 1864 law, and said, you know, it could be a model for other states. She's in a very different position now. She wants Katie Hobbs to do something differently. She's prevailing on some of the same Republicans who are in the state legislature who also pushed for that 1864 law. And what's so remarkable about this is the justices in Arizona had a choice. They could go with 1864 or they could go with 2022, right? The 2022 law being a 15-week ban. They chose 1864, right? You have Democrats who really want to say that Republicans are radical, that they want to take the country back. And listen, they have been delivered a gift by this state Supreme Court because this is exactly what they want to do. They want to go back to before Arizona was even a state.
I was just going to say
that. Did not have the right to vote. Black people in some states were still enslaved, and they are saying this is the model. And then, of course, you had Carrie Lake back then saying that this should be a model. This is hugely significant in this race. It's going to, I think, turbocharge these efforts to get it on the ballot. Some of the activists there are saying they already have enough signatures. They need something like 364,000 by July 4th. So this has really, I think, upended this race, which was, I think, primarily about immigration, and now you have abortion added to the mix.
Well, certainly. And also, this is part of the messaging of the extreme. Actually, the Democratic strategist I spoke with this morning pointed out exactly that. Now we can say, look who's actually in the more extreme party. But also framing it in healthcare and personal freedoms, right? This is where the overarching message of the Biden campaign has been, and in down ballot races too. And so this gives them an opportunity to make headway where immigration is hitting Arizona very hard. I mean, that is the part of the border, a section of the border that is seeing a record number of crossings. Now they can sort of pivot on the abortion front.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the fact that Arizona, it's not as if they didn't have a more recent law on the books, and a law that I think probably, I know, has a lot more mainstream support, which is you can have an abortion up to 15 weeks of pregnancy. What the governor is arguing is that this isn't just about abortion. It's going to go beyond abortion. Listen to Katie Hobbs.
These extreme legislators sent a fetal personhood bill to my desk that I was able to veto last year. This is a bill that would have paved the way for an Alabama-style ruling that would ban IVF. In Arizona, they're going after contraception. This doesn't stop at abortion.
I think voters are starting to realize that as well, especially after the Alabama ruling on IVF, when, you know, you had so many congressional Republicans saying, oh, no, you know, we're not going to be talking about IVF or birth control. We're seeing that happen, and it could absolutely happen in Arizona.
Okay, everybody stand by. Democrats are hoping that this issue of abortion rights are top of mind for voters in November. Polls also show inflation and the broader economy are even more important at this point. The president didn't get some great news on that front this morning. Inflation rose 3.5%, the highest since September. Americans are paying more for gas, for food, and housing. CNN's Rahel Solomon is with me now. Rahel, what else does this report show?
Yeah, well, I mean, Dana, you laid it out pretty well there, but it's really gas and housing that were the largest contributors here to the price hike that we saw. So this was higher than we were expecting. It was higher than the month prior. And as you pointed out, it's the sort of fastest pace we've seen since 6 months or so. So 3.5%. To put that in perspective, Dana, the expectation was 3.4%. Even on a monthly basis, prices came in hotter than expected. So CPI, or the Consumer Price Index report, this is just one inflation report that the Fed uses to help guide its decisions, but it's an important one. There are three inflation reports, but it is an important one. So what happens here really matters. I want to go through some components for you where we saw prices increase. As we said, gas was a pretty big contributor, 1.7%. That's a pretty big deal. Food prices only modestly, but still increasing a bit. And shelter prices. So shelter has been especially sticky. And we had been actually hoping, and when you think shelter, you think rent inflation, rent prices, you think sort of the price to put a roof over your head, if you want to put it that way. We had actually been hoping to get some progress on shelter inflation, but that has not happened. And so that's part of what we've seen. And if you're looking at the markets today, you'll probably notice that it's a pretty rough day. And the reason why is not just because of what this report tells us about the path of inflation as it has been, but also the path of rate cuts in the future. And so the expectation had been, Dana, as you know, that we would start to see rate cuts from the Fed perhaps as early as June. The door has practically been shut on that after this report, because essentially what you have, this is now the third CPI report after January, after February. Now you have March coming in hotter, which suggests that inflation is sort of stuck, right? And so it's really remarkable, because we've gone from rate cuts are absolutely coming in 2024. That was the consensus not a long time ago. And then it became, last week we heard one Fed official say, well, maybe we don't need rate cuts at all in 2024. And that set off some alarm bells. And now you're hearing, after this report, one prominent economist pointed out, maybe the next move from the Fed is actually a rate hike.
Oh my
goodness. It is really remarkable what has happened. But essentially, you have an economy that's still strong in terms of the labor market, in terms of consumer spending, but you have prices and inflation that appear to be stuck.
Yeah. And anybody out there who has been waiting for those rates to come down to buy a house does not want to hear what you just said. Rahel, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Coming up, quote, the Lord Jesus himself could not manage this conference, end quote. That's how one House Republican is describing the battle within the party over whether the relatively new speaker should keep his job. New developments on that story after a quick break.
Hi. I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
I'm a health reporter and have been for 15 years. And even I feel overwhelmed by some of the things I read about the stuff we're eating.
My colleague Meg Terrell wanted to take a deep dive into something you've probably heard a lot about recently. Ultra-processed foods. There is a lot to learn there, some fascinating stuff. And some of it is probably going to change the way you shop. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, to be a fly on the wall right now. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is meeting with House Speaker Mike Johnson for the first time since she began her efforts to oust him. Greene has been crusading for his removal, saying that the very conservative Johnson is compromising too much with Democrats. Here's what Speaker Johnson said right before that meeting.
I've always considered her a friend. Marjorie and I don't disagree, I don't think, on any matter of philosophy. We're both conservatives. We're not going to get all of our priorities. We will never get 100% of what we want and believe is necessary for the country.
CNN's Lauren Fox is on Capitol Hill, just right down the hall from where they're meeting. Lauren, what are you hearing?
Yeah, it's been just over 30 minutes since this meeting began. Marjorie Taylor Greene having this conversation with the speaker after they failed to connect during that two-week Easter recess. Johnson had said that he had planned to have a phone call with her. That phone call, according to our sources, never happened. So this is a very critical meeting for Speaker Mike Johnson. It is also a meeting where it's very unclear what he could tell her that would assuage her concerns about his leadership. She has such a long list, Dana, as you know, as to what her concerns about Johnson are. She's unhappy about the way that he passed several spending bills with Democratic votes. She's unhappy with the way that he is moving forward with the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act renewal right now in the House of Representatives. And she's frustrated with the fact that he is looking to try and pass additional aid for Ukraine, something that he has made clear is a priority for him, is a priority for many defense hawks within the Republican Party, but something that badly divides the Republican conference. And she's argued all of this without saying precisely when she's going to trigger a motion to vacate, a vote to try and oust the speaker. So in many ways, Johnson is trying to govern in this two-seat majority as he is facing this threat about his job, and as he is coming to the realization that any action he takes, any action to govern, any action to do his job could be met with this very important vote that Marjorie Taylor Greene could trigger at any time to try to get rid of him, Dana. So it's an impossible situation. Meanwhile, other Republicans deeply frustrated with the fact that they think Marjorie Taylor Greene is hijacking the conference. Here they are.
It's an impossible job. The Lord Jesus himself could not manage this conference or this congress. You just can't do it.
I think Mike Johnson is a great human. He doesn't lie like the last guy.
I think people don't like dysfunction, so that's not good for our side. And with a one-seat majority, it only takes a couple people to create dysfunction.
I think Speaker Johnson is working his guts out, doing the best he can with a lot of feral cats.
And the wild card here is if Marjorie Taylor Greene tries to take out Speaker Johnson, who would join her in that effort? And then what do Democrats do, Dana? I think that that's a key question here. They could obviously step in to try to table any effort to get rid of the speaker, but obviously they're not going to do that in the conversations I've had with them for free. Dana?
Yeah, they're definitely going to try to extract some compromises out of him, and that will put him maybe in a different situation. Very, very complicated. Let us know if you see any white smoke from that meeting. Appreciate it, Lauren. The panel is back here. And Mariana, you've written extensively about this, including, I was just looking at, you said that according to one Republican you spoke to, it is the silent majority now in the Republican conference that continues to move away from the speaker. We heard some different sentiment in those sound bites, but it's a very big conference.
Yeah, I mean, there are a majority, I would say, of Republicans who do not want to vacate the speaker, but that doesn't mean that they aren't very upset with him. I mean, there are so many conservatives, and I've heard from many privately, who are literally questioning what it means to be a Republican. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because we have seen Johnson have to rely on Democrats because the far right members of the conference just do not allow anything to pass. It's possible today, for example, on that Foreign Surveillance Act, mm-hmm. that rule could fail on the floor because there's just so many objections. Johnson, as McCarthy had to do, had to rely on Democrats to pass things. And many Republicans also upset with how they just funded the government. That is what triggered Marjorie Taylor Greene to drop this warning, is what she's calling it. Mm-hmm. But again, anything could trigger her to move it forward, put it up for a floor vote. And it is unclear right now just how many Republicans could potentially join her because of, just besides her, how upset Republicans are, how much they do not want Ukraine funding, want a number of different things that Johnson literally has to address and piece together.
And let me just put some numbers up on the screen so our viewers really understand just how tight this is. Right now it's 218 to 213, four vacancies. It will be an additional vacancy after Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin leaves. He's just leaving next Friday. That's how tight this is. And that is true for the legislation that you were talking about, which is most important. It's also true for his ability, Mike Johnson's ability to keep his job if it comes to that.
And for the White House to pass its priorities. I mean, that's the real consequence of this, particularly when you're looking at Ukraine aid. The White House for months has been saying that they need to get those funds to Ukraine in their war against Russia. In fact, it's going to come up likely in the president's meeting today with Japan's prime minister. This isn't something that just has consequences domestically. It is something that the president is having to acknowledge on the world stage.
Nia, the crazy eight is what Kevin McCarthy calls the eight people
who, lovingly
who vote. Yes. The opposite of lovingly voted to oust him. Right now, let's just look at where they are. Three, including Matt Gaetz, opposes doing the same to Johnson. There are four who are not saying what they would do. But on the subject of Matt Gaetz, Kevin McCarthy was at Georgetown this week, and he was incredibly blunt, candid, and sharp about Matt Gaetz.
Give you the truth about that now. And I'll give you the truth why I'm not speaker. It's because one person, a member of Congress, wanted me to stop an ethics complaint because he slept with a 17-year-old. An ethics complaint that started before I ever became speaker, and that's illegal, and I'm not going to get in the middle. Did he do it or not? I don't know.
Okay, before you jump in, I just need to say that the DOJ did investigate Congressman Gaetz for sex trafficking. They looked into allegations that he had sexual relations with an underage girl. They dropped the investigation in February of 2023. He denies the allegations, and Gaetz responded to McCarthy saying, Kevin is a liar, which actually is why he isn't speaker. Just ask any of the 224 people who voted to remove him.
Listen, you know, Kevin McCarthy obviously still dealing emotionally with what it means to not be speaker anymore and the fact that Matt Gaetz is the one who dealt him that fate. You know, it's also true that Kevin McCarthy empowered a lot of these folks who, you know, he wants to call the crazy eight, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's obviously causing problems for Mike Johnson now. None of this is great for the Republican brand. They are arguing to Americans that they should be in charge, and they are demonstrating that they are having real problems governing and coming to any sort of consensus. I mean, at the root of the problem is that they don't really want to govern, right? They sort of don't want to get anything done. They're a caucus that is full of obstructionists who don't really see the government as a positive force in Americans' lives. And so here they are in chaos. It's not a surprise that we're here again with Mike Johnson. This kind of chaos dominated McCarthy's time as speaker as well. You know, I think the saving grace for Mike Johnson is who else would want this job at this point? Who else could get it?
Or could get the vote.
Yeah, who else could get it? And so that, I think, is maybe the only thing keeping him here.
Yeah, I mean, Republicans can't agree on anything.
Yeah.
And they have a way narrow margin than they did when they elected Johnson. There is no one else. No. There is no one else.
Okay, a live look at the Rose Garden. Very soon, President Biden will be holding a joint news conference with the Prime Minister of Japan. I think we have a live picture of the Rose Garden. If not, we're going to give it to you on the other side of the break. You're going to want to see it, so stick around. There's the picture of the Rose Garden. We're obviously still waiting for people to get in and to get seated and for the president and the Japanese prime minister to come out there. They are together for a very important meeting. They first met in the Oval Office just in the last hour. Kayla Tausche is live from the White House. Why is the White House calling this visit the dawn of a new era in U.S. in U.S.-Japan relations, Kayla?
Well, Dana, the way that the administration puts it, they say that the two countries are taking their security alliance to the next level, thanks in no small part to changes that Japan has made at the bureaucratic level to allow it to engage on a deeper level with the U.S. and allow things like, for instance, the export of weaponry developed in Japan, the export of military technology that will allow it to produce and sell military aid to other countries around the world. Officials say that that in particular has made a very big change to this relationship. And so they're going to be announcing quite a few new items of deliverables on the military and defense front. But they're also expected to cover the waterfront of climate, space, artificial intelligence, and technology across a host of partnerships that the two countries say are first of their kind. Here's how they said it in their words earlier today.
I would assert our alliance has never been stronger in our entire history. But today, I look forward to discussing how we can even deepen it more, including increasing defense and then technology and cooperation across the board. We can continue to enhance and ensure Indo-Pacific remains a free, open, and prosperous region of the world with us standing together.
Now, the purpose of this state visit now and these deeper partnerships now is twofold. First, the countries want to put up a counteroffensive to China and its increasing hostility in the South China Sea and the broader Indo-Pacific region. That's why they're going to bring the president of the Philippines in for a first ever trilateral tomorrow, where they're going to announce some military exercises and some infrastructure investments. But then administration officials also note the domestic element here, the need to put some permanence on the relationship between the U.S. and Japan because of what could potentially happen later this year, Dana.
Okay, Kayla, thanks for that report. Excuse me. And we are waiting to see the two gentlemen in the Rose Garden. When that happens, I know you will let us know. The panel is back here. Just talk for a second. You also cover the White House about this kind of meeting. And, you know, back in the day, Ronald Reagan used to call it the Rose Garden strategy. This is quite literally in the Rose Garden on a pretty day in Washington. How does the Biden campaign view events like this?
They view it as a way to say the U.S. has reaffirmed its position on the world stage. We're showing that to you. And look what could be at risk if the president's Republican rival were to take the helm again. I think this is an interesting moment for President Biden, too, because he does often pull on his foreign policy experience on the campaign trail. And we saw this play out with NATO. I mean, he harkens back to his history and background and foreign policy to make his case on the campaign trail. And that is what we see in moments like this, too. This is where he's most comfortable. This is where he gets to say, I'm working on this relationship, this coordination with a key ally in the Indo-Pacific region, and this is what is at stake with all of the conflicts abroad if we don't keep up these alliances. So for the campaign, if anything, the conventional is good here, and they can use this as another example of the president showing that the U.S. can still lead, whereas they can cast doubt on whether that was the case when the former president was there.
That's really interesting and an important note. Another interesting thing that happened is the president's former chief of staff, Ron Klain, who is not just his former chief of staff. He has been with Joe Biden since he was a senator in various BFFs. Incarnations, yeah. Very, very close. He had the following to say in an audio tape. Can you still say tape? In an audio tape obtained by Politico. Oh, I'm going to read this. I think the president is out there too much talking about bridges. He does two or three events a week, and where he's cutting a ribbon on a bridge. And here's a bridge. Like I tell you, if you go into the grocery store, you go to the grocery store and, you know, eggs and milk are expensive, the fact that there's a effing bridge is not inaudible. Ron Klain was famously the person who would drive to work specifically down certain streets so he could see what the gas prices were when he was working at the White House. He is, I think, understandably obsessed with those pocketbook issues. And the fact that he's so out there vocally criticizing what the current campaign and the current White House are doing? What does that tell you?
Listen, I'm sure he's probably privately telling them this as well. The Biden campaign, they have to figure out a way to go to these swing states and say to these voters, we delivered. We were able to get this big infrastructure deal done, and look, there is a bridge. And listen, we understand how important bridges are, particularly given what's happened in Baltimore. But Ron Klain isn't wrong here, right? People experience the economy. People experience progress or lack of progress in terms of the economy at the gas pump, at the Piggly Wiggly, at the Winn-Dixie, at the Farmer Jack's, at wherever you are shopping to get your groceries. How many bags can you get for 50 bucks, right? You know, that's how people experience the economy. And so the Biden team has yet to figure out how to sort of change the trajectory, right? Bidenomics didn't quite work. Mm-hmm. You can't say, look at these great numbers. You certainly can't say, look at this great bridge. And so that's what Ron Klain is getting at, and they haven't quite figured it out yet.
Piggly Wiggly might be the best name for a grocery store ever.
Very good grocery store.
But on that note, you are seeing the president and his aides, but even the president, maybe not out there as much as a lot of people in his party want him to be out there, but just yesterday he did a pretty long interview with Univision. And in it, he was talking about some of the things on home prices and on home affordability that his administration has tried to do that maybe haven't gotten a lot of attention. And most importantly, to Nia's point, haven't sort of seeped in with the voters who are frustrated in this case, not being able to buy a house. He talked about providing millions of new homes, rental assistance, and things like that.
I mean, that's the difficulty, is how do you let people know, convince them that while, yes, you are experiencing this with the economy, when you go to the grocery store, there are other things happening. These are the things that we've been able to accomplish. And I mean, I kind of always think about the Affordable Care Act way back when. Democrats are saying, this is going to help you. This is going to transform your lives. And Americans just weren't thinking about it. It just wasn't until they really were feeling it. Once they finally saw, eventually see that bridge in their community, they're going to say, okay, Democrats did this for me. But it's just so hard at this point in time for the president, I would even argue congressional Democrats, they could go out there and say, we're doing this for you. It's just so hard to tap into that emotional feeling that voters have.
We're going to have to take a quick break. But before we do, just on that note, we have a headline from the Wall Street Journal talking about Biden pitching accomplishments that can't make it past the noise. His campaign is promoting the effort that they've pushed to fight climate change, $1 trillion. Voters don't care. But in that story, once they learned of what the president and his team were doing, they say, oh, OK, well, that's good. One example. All right, everybody, coming up, the presidential election could hinge on one single electoral vote in Nebraska. We've got the latest on Republican efforts to change the rules there to boost Donald Trump. And independent presidential candidate Cornel West just announced his running mate. We're going to tell you about that after the break.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just into CNN, independent presidential candidate Cornel West picked his running mate. It is Malina Abdullah, one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matters, who now works for as a Pan-African Studies professor at Cal State University in Los Angeles. West made the announcement moments ago on the Travis Smiley Show. He said this about Abdullah. She has a record of deep commitment and investment in ensuring that poor and working people are at the center of her vision. Now to a potential change that could have enormous consequences on the 2024 presidential election. Republicans want to change the way the state of Nebraska awards its electoral votes, which could be an election-deciding boost for Donald Trump. The state's Republican governor is now promising to call a special legislative session when, he says, there is sufficient support in the legislature to pass it. Our Jeff Zeleny is tracking this from Omaha. Jeff, I'm sure it's nice to be back in your home state. You've been doing a lot of reporting out there on what is going to happen. What are you hearing from your sources at this point?
Well, Dana, it's so interesting. Nebraska and Maine, of course, are the only two states in the country that divide their electoral votes. So come November, that is certainly something that is going to be front and center in this campaign. But both presidential campaigns have been watching this very carefully. This is not new. For about 30 years or so, this has been done in Nebraska. But suddenly it is gaining fresh attention, and here is why. Because of the closeness of this race and the sort of changing nature of the battlegrounds, if President Biden wins Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania and nothing else, he would win the presidency with this electoral vote here in Omaha. If he does not, it could be a tied race that is sent to the House of Representatives. So that is the backdrop to all of this here. And this basically was going without much attention last week until conservative activist Charlie Kirk started raising attention to this. He was right here in Omaha last night urging Nebraskans to press this issue.
We want to see, and we're going to see this story come to completion. We are going to keep on pushing and keep on pushing and keep on pushing until Nebraska gets winner take all.
Nebraska could pick a president.
Nebraska could pick a president.
So because of that campaign of pressure on state Republicans here, including the governor of Nebraska, Jim Pillen, now he is promising to call a special session of the legislature. So Democrats are vowing to fight this as well. We caught up with the executive director of the Nebraska Democratic Party, who actually cast the electoral vote in 2024, Joe Biden, here. She said Democrats are pushing back.
What they just didn't understand was is that we're small, but we're mighty. And there's people here that are ready to take up that fight, and we're going to do that. And so I feel the past, they maybe didn't see how valuable it is. But I always tell people, I tell people all the time, if people didn't know how valuable our vote is, they wouldn't be doing so many laws to try to restrict our vote.
And perhaps that is the irony here, Dana, of there's been a lot of talk about election laws over the past 4 years. Well, Republicans now are trying to change state election law for something they believe does not benefit them. There's also another subtext of the Electoral College here. Many Democrats have been opposed to that. Well, that is also at play here. So this is just the beginning, likely, of this conversation. But the reason this one electoral vote matters is because of the tight race here and the potential of a 269 tie that, again, would send this race to the House of Representatives. So for now, all sides are digging in on this electoral fight.
Yeah, I mean, listening to
vote here in Nebraska.
Yeah, and listening to Republicans after 20, you would be shocked to see that they are trying to change the law in a state to benefit them. Thank you so much for that, Jeff. Appreciate it. We are standing by for a rare presidential news conference. President Biden is about to speak to reporters along with the Japanese Prime Minister. Stick around. You are looking at live pictures of the White House Rose Garden. Very soon, President Biden will hold a joint news conference with the Prime Minister of Japan. We look forward to seeing what they say and also the questions that we expect them to take from reporters, both the Japanese Prime Minister and President Biden. Thank you so much for joining Inside Politics today. Stand by because we're going to bring that to you via CNN News Central, which starts after a break.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832 and tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.